From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The University of Michigan has become the latest to face sexual misconduct charges against senior leadership.
He is essentially the number two at University of Michigan. He's the chief budget and academic officer.
We'll speak with one reporter covering the charges against Martin Filbert. Also, an update on the trial of a one-time ally of Larry Nassar, accused of lying to police. We'll check in with two adjacent Michigan counties. One voted to become a gun law sanctuary, one declined. And a curator at Detroit Institute of Arts talks about how portraits of African Americans tell truths that history books gloss over.
I am a person who doesn't believe in having to fudge the truth about history just because I'm talking to a white audience.
That's coming up on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, we're going to talk about the growing number of Michigan counties approving sanctuary resolutions on gun rights.
We need to reassure the citizens of the county that we are not going to just allow our elected officials at any level to just go ahead and stomp on our rights without a fight.
But first, we have a couple of updates for you on cases within higher education that pose challenges to how our schools are dealing with sexual misconduct. Kathy Klages was once a beloved longtime coach for the Michigan State University gymnastics team. But as the case against disgraced Dr. Larry Nassar unfolded, she was accused by survivors of failing to alert authorities to claims of sexual abuse. Klages is now standing trial. She's charged with lying to police during the investigations and Nassar's abuse. Two former gymnasts say that they told the gymnastics coach that they had been abused by Nassar. But Klages told police in 2018 she did not remember those conversations. Ariana Taylor has been reporting on the trial for the Detroit News, and she joins us now. Ariana, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give us a quick summary of the charges against Klages?
Yeah, so right now, Kathy Klages is facing two counts, one felony and one misdemeanor, of lying to a peace officer or the police officer investigating Larry Nassar. If convicted, she could face up to 4 years in prison.
Have the prosecutors, what stage are we in now with the prosecutors laying out their case?
So right now, technically, we've only had one full day of a trial or court session. The court session for today on Wednesday was canceled because one of the prosecution's key witnesses had a sudden death in her family. So they kind of canceled today's court sessions to give the prosecution time to, reevaluate and figure out what they're going to do moving forward. But, so far we've only had one full day of trial, and that has been just a handful of witnesses testifying.
Have you had any sense yet of how the prosecutors are trying to portray Klages' relationship with Larry Nassar?
Yeah, so especially in the prosecutor's opening statement, they made it very clear that Klages had a close relationship with Nassar and that she was, a close friend with him and kind of protecting him in the beginning. I can read you kind of a quote from one of the prosecutor's opening statement. She said, telling the truth when it is most difficult for a person matters. Difficult because it involves a personal friend of over 30 years. Difficult because it involves your career. Difficult because it involves the brand of a college where you've worked for many years.
Hmm. Larissa Boyce was scheduled to take the stand on Tuesday. She was one of the first women to publicly accuse Nassar of abuse. What was her testimony like?
Ms. Boyce, her testimony, there was a lot of emotion in what she was saying. She expressed many times that it was a lot of trauma that she went through, and it was a lot for her even now, even after all this time and all, I'm sure she's been on that witness stand many times already. It was still, a lot for her to recount what happened all those years ago again. As far as the questioning, things did get a little tense when Klages' attorney was questioning her. She seemed to get a little bit upset. It was just, a tense situation and environment.
Right. Have you been able to get much of a sense, either from the cross-examination or from opening statements, what the strategy looks like for Kathy Klages' defense attorneys?
Well, they made it very clear from the beginning in the opening statement that this is a case about memory. So really, they're not trying to focus so much on if that meeting happened or, you know, who said this or who said what, but mainly on if they just told the truth, which is what she's, you know, going, what she's being charged with. And so they're really trying to focus on, you know, her memory and making sure that everyone can realize if she was really telling the truth during her interview when they were asking her about, did she know about Nasser's abuse before 2016.
Obviously, as you say, things have come to a bit of a stop since one of the witnesses had a death in the family. But do you have any sense of what may come next, or how many, have you been able to tell from court filings how many witnesses may be called?
So, yeah, I do have the witness list. On here, they have about 9 witnesses that they have scheduled to come. I'm not sure about the witness that did have a death. I'm not sure if they will be, if she'll be able to testify at all, but as far as what they submitted, there were 9 witnesses.
And so how many did they get through yesterday? Just the one?
Oh, no, we did 4, or they did 4.
Oh, okay. So we're about halfway through.
Yeah. So they talked, Larissa Boyce testified, David Dyer, who was one of the investigators that questioned or interviewed Klages, Andrea Mumford, which was another investigator that interviewed Klages at the same time as Dyer. And then it was an anonymous victim or survivor, I should say, that testified as well.
Has there been any talk yet of when a verdict could be expected?
Yeah, so Judge Dragunchuk, she has been making it a priority for the jury, at least, to kind of finish this out by the end of this week. She did say that canceling today's court session was not going to hold them back at all as far as time. But at the latest, she's saying, because next Monday is a holiday, at the latest she was saying maybe Tuesday or Wednesday, but they're aiming for the end of this week.
Well, thanks for catching us up on the case. We appreciate your time.
No problem. My pleasure.
In other news, the University of Michigan is investigating its provost, Martin Filbert. Allegations of sexual misconduct came to light in January. 6 women from 4 institutions, including the U of M, have come forward. Recent reporting by some news sources suggests that there may be more than a few others. Kim Kozlowski is the higher education reporter at the Detroit News, and she's been following this story. Kim, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me, April.
Can you tell us a little bit about Martin Filbert and who he is within his field?
Martin Filbert is the provost as well as the executive vice president for academic affairs at University of Michigan. He is essentially the number 2 at University of Michigan. He's the chief budget and academic officer. Additionally, he is also a pretty well-known toxicology professor.
What do we know about the allegations made against him?
Well, we know that several emerged in January, and that University of Michigan immediately put him on administrative leave. They appointed an interim to step in. And right now, the University of Michigan has doing an internal investigation, but they have also hired an outside firm. And at this point, the institution hasn't revealed anything about what the allegations are, but they have said that they're taking the allegations seriously and sexual misconduct will not be tolerated.
Any of these claims involve students?
The university said when allegations first came out about Filbert that the ones that initially had come forward did not involve students.
It appears that Filbert was promoted several times over the course of his career, despite in some cases anonymous warnings and in other cases possibly involving more detailed complaints. What does it say that the university may have known that there was a problem and did not act? Has there been much reaction from others within the organization?
I cannot comment on other allegations. We have not reported any allegations. While we've received them, we want to be bulletproof before we publish them. We did, however, get a letter that was sent to President Schlissel that said they had lost faith in the Office of Institutional Equity, which is the office that does investigate allegations of sexual misconduct. And they pointed to a professor, Nat Filbert, that had allegations against them and how they felt dissatisfied by how the case was handled. The university did not comment on the case, but the letter was signed by over 60 people, students and faculty members. However, one of the board members, the chair of the board, Ron Weiser, said that the university gets numerous letters signed by numerous people. So that was at least one reaction to this letter. But there does seem to be a sentiment, at least in the U of M's Computer Science and Engineering Department, as well as the School of Information, which is where all the signatures came from, that there was dissatisfaction. They wanted President Schlissel to come in and make some changes and protect what they said were protect survivors and the larger community.
Kim, your beat is higher education, but it certainly seems like anyone who's either involved with or covering the industry is spending an awful lot of time on sexual harassment or sexual abuse claims. Would you say that you've seen a change over the past 10 years in how institutions handle this?
I do think that more people are starting to come forward and speak about what they regard as inappropriate behavior. And I do think their claims are taken more seriously than ever before. I might even trace some of the change to the women who came forward and spoke about Larry Nassar over 9 consecutive days a few years ago. They basically came forward, they showed their faces, they talked about what sexual assault looks like, and the whole world was riveted and they watched. And I think that was a watershed moment in what we continue to see as people come forward and talk about sexual misconduct.
Kim Kozlowski covers higher ed for the Detroit News. Kim, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, April.
If you've ever visited the Detroit Institute of Arts, you know one of the many incredible things the museum has is an extensive collection of work by African-American artists. However, through the centuries, white Western artists' depictions of black people have been controversial at best.
Basically ignored, they were really not there, or if they were depicted in art, it was often in a somewhat derogatory way.
Coming up, a conversation with the DIA's curator of African American art, Valerie Mercer. That's next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm April Baer. In 2015, the writer and scholar Robin Costi Lewis created book-length poetry from the outdated and often outrageous captions found on classic works of art from Western civilization, paintings featuring black people, always created by white artists. If you've never read Voyage of the Sable Venus, it's an amazing book. Contemporary African-American artists are working hard to address the imbalances, giving us images that redefine the black experience. This month, as we think about what art can tell us about black history and black life, we made a trip to the Detroit Institute of Arts to talk to the museum's amazing curator of African-American art, Valerie Mercer, and of course, to look at some work with her. Well, first of all, Valerie Mercer, thank you so much for being here, and welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here with you in the museum.
Sure. I was a little tickled to see that you were seated in front of this work by Micheline Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to think about an entry point for the diversity of work that's on view as part of this show, but could you talk a little bit about what we're sitting in front of right now?
Sure. Well, these are permanent collection galleries, and we have about 5 devoted to African American art. This painting that we're sitting in front of is by the contemporary artist Micheline Thomas. And this is a work that we purchased just a few years ago. I think I was walking around the galleries one day, and I thought, which I do occasionally, think about what's missing and what we need. And I immediately thought about Micheline's work. We didn't have anything by her. And I started, you know, talking to her gallery about it. And this came up, and I went to see it. I thought it was just such a beautiful, you know, painting, and like the way Micheline works, it's a mixed media work. So she's added all these Swarovski, you know, stones, rhinestones,
crystals.
It's all over. I just loved how sort of blatantly decorative it was.
The portrait is this explosively colorful image of a woman in repose on a couch.
But you don't see, you know, work depicting African-American women within the history of art, really. So I had been paying attention to her work because that's very much her specialty. And as I said, I do think about, like, what's missing, and especially trying to get, you know, different audiences in to see the galleries and all. And so I knew I had to get one of her works. And I was just so delighted when I found this one. And then, you know, when I presented it, and it went through pretty, you know, smoothly, and people were excited about it. But I loved it because I actually had seen Micheline's work a few years ago when she was in the Studio Museum in Harlem's Artist in Residence program. I used to work there.
At the Studio Museum in Harlem. Yes.
Yeah. And it's like the premier museum of African American art. And I occasionally, when I visit New York, I go by the Artist in Residence program. And she was in the program at that time. The work she did at that time was smaller in scale. But I do remember being really taken aback by the decorative elements she had in the work. And I remember thinking that that was pretty bold, but I liked it because I see it as making a blatant statement about the, you know, femininity, that it is definitely about women. And that's always been, to some extent, anything that reeked of, you know, femininity in art for a very long time was really considered a negative. You know, if you told a male artist that you thought their work, even if it was abstraction, but you told them you thought it was pretty, that they were very uncomfortable. I know male artists who would joke with me about that, because I would come out sometime and say, oh, this is really beautiful, or this is pretty. I was fine, but it was almost like a no-no.
This work feels like it draws on some of the best of pop art, while bringing touches of authenticity and hominess in the wood paneling that's part of the background, all the patterns and fabrics that are portrayed in how she's sitting. I mean, it feels like home, but a particularly splendid view of home.
Yeah, well, Micheline is a well-trained artist. She knows art history, you know, and contemporary art, and also she certainly is aware of, you know, pop art, but a lot of her works, and this one included, have to do with the fact that she was very young, correctly a little girl during the 70s, and her mother was at some point, you know, a runway model, a fashion model. And so
there's a strong understanding of fashion in her work.
Yeah, but I think for, like really for a lot of little girls, you know, their sense of fashion and even femininity often does kind of start with their mother. I remember being a little girl and my mom would get fashion magazines and I would just curl up on the floor and I just loved looking at the pictures. And I loved it when my mom got dressed up, you know, and especially if she would ask me to help her pick out earrings. And Micheline has similar stories, you know, about her mother, but it's all done very lovingly. But it's a period, I think, in her life that she recalls with a great deal of affection for her mother, who died just a few years ago, but sort of, she does call her mother her muse for her art.
What's important to understand about how Black women and men have been treated as subjects in most of the Western canon?
Well, you know, they often were basically ignored. They were really not there, or if they were depicted in art, it was often in a somewhat derogatory way, you know, through things like caricature or being seen in, you know, very negative light. So,
not to mention, being expected images, not to mention the images of black people as a stand-in for a sense of wildness.
Oh, sure. No, it was always often referring to, you know, there were just all these negative stereotypes about black people. They were portrayed in, you know, popular and sometimes even in, you know, fine art. But with the Harlem Renaissance, that started to change because basically I feel the intellectual foundation that supported the Harlem Renaissance, because you had people like, Alain Locke and W.E.B. Du Bois and other black intellectuals encouraging artists to basically define the image of their people. These were, you know, they were really talking to African-American artists. That was a responsibility they had to overturn the stereotypes.
Is that a place where you see artists starting to turn the page and create more of a sense of agency for their subjects?
Yeah, because you really don't see, some 19th century African-American artists portrayed black people, but it was still quite rare because most African-Americans could not, you know, commission artists. They didn't have the means to do that. Occasionally, there were people like Henry Ossawa Tanner and Duncanson who may have done portraits of African Americans, but they were usually prominent individuals like a minister, you know, prominent in their community, who also had the means to commission them. But on the whole, they're very rare, and most of those artists did, you know, things like Tanner specialized in biblical subject matter. Duncanson specialized in landscape painting. So it isn't until the Harlem Renaissance period, but again, the Harlem Renaissance really has to be understood as the offshoot of movements like the New Negro Movement, which had this very strong black intellectual foundation. Because, sometimes people think that these cultural movements just come out of the air, but they never do.
They're part of their times.
Yeah, but you do need sort of the thinkers behind it, you know, to give it some kind of firm foundation. Elaine Locke particularly was a really important figure for the Harlem Renaissance, you know, writers and eventually artists. But, you know, he emphasized that was a responsibility of those creative people to overturn the negative stereotypes about African-American artists, African-American people, I'm sorry.
Valerie, you curated a 2008 exhibition called 30 Americans that had a huge effect on how museum goers in the modern era look at black art and black portraiture.
Sure.
First of all, it was one of the most widely viewed traveling exhibitions. This thing toured for 10 years around the country. That just never happens. You know, a lot of people in a lot of places around the U.S. got to see this show. And some scholars have written about how the tour in some ways stoked collectors and, by extension, museums to take a more serious look at work by African-American artists. A collector starts to think about it, starts buying works, and eventually those works find their way into our museums.
Sure.
Do you think that portraiture benefits when black art is regarded more seriously by collectors and museums?
Yes, I think that, an exhibition like that I have to say, it did travel to various museums, and as would happen in all those museums, you know, curator does take responsibility for curating it, but it did originate with the Rubel's institution. The Rubel family owns that collection, and it has been very popular, and it was wonderful to work on here. I think that exhibition did help to change a lot of people's thinking about African-American art. But I have to say, you know, having worked at the Studio Museum for a number of years, and I am from the East Coast originally, that show was wonderful, but it seemed to me kind of normal, like what you could see in places like the Studio Museum and some institutions in New York. I just kept wondering, when was it going to catch up to, you know, when were other art museums going to catch up to that? But finally, you know, they did, and they have been. And I thought it was just a wonderful exhibition.
Because we should say, there's a huge underrepresentation of African-American artists to this day in most of our institutions.
That's true. That's definitely true. But I think right now, certainly in the art world, a lot of the really stars in the contemporary art world are African-American artists. And
Kara Walker, Kehinde Wiley.
Yeah, but, you know, I think I could see that coming, you know, again, probably because I worked at the Studio Museum. You know, a lot of those artists came out of the Studio Museum's Artist in Residence program. Not Kara, but certainly Kerry James Marshall, mm-hmm. so many people who were in that show. So none of it surprised me how successful a lot of them are. I mean, Kehinde came out of that program. I was thrilled to have it here because I knew some of the artists. I also knew a lot about them. I know, too, the impact of that program on a lot of artists. You know, it really jumpstarts their career because the New York Times writes a critical review of their exhibition, which they do at the Studio Museum after a year when the program ends. But they often get a lot of attention. But having that show here, I was just so thrilled because it got a lot of people very excited. We had wonderful attendance for that show. The audience was, you know, extremely diverse in age and race. And whenever we did programs, we got good attendance for it. And it was like that until the show's last day. But it was such a nice variety.
A lot of Americans who may not go to museums a lot may have a familiarity with black portraiture through the presence of the presidential portraits that were done of Barack
right.
and Michelle Obama mm-hmm. by Kehinde Wiley in the case of the former president and Amy Sherald in the case
right.
of the former first lady. This was a face of black portraiture that certainly hadn't been among the presidential portraits in the National Gallery and that sort of became part of a national awareness and conversation mm-hmm. about these images. What did it mean to you to see those contemporary artists representing in that way?
Oh, I was thrilled. I loved the portraits. I thought it was so smart of them to choose, you know, two stars in the art world. Because the paintings, of course, were very innovative for portraiture.
They're very modern by the standards of presidential portraits.
Yeah. And that's really what portraiture is like today. You know, most artists, you know, they, unless they're a sort of traditional portrait painter who does these things on commissions, you know, all the time, most artists want to be selected for their style, which in the case of Kehinde and Amy, they were. And so they bring to the work innovative aspects of their own styles and in many ways their own vision. I often feel when you look at, you know, the portraiture and even other art by a lot of the contemporary artists today, you really see the artists there as well. You know, it's not only the former president, Barack Obama, and the former first lady. You know, you also see Kehinde in there, and you see Amy in her portrait of Michelle. Because they are injecting sort of their vision into how they see these two famous people, you know, but it's their own distinct, you know, take on Barack Obama and Michelle Obama.
Black identity has had to mean so many different things by necessity, from what's expressed within black communities
sure.
and what can safely be expressed to a wider world. Is it important as we look at black portraiture to try to see things through multiple lenses?
I think it's really important for everybody, everyone, regardless of the racial background, to get somewhat the same message. I am a person who doesn't believe in having to fudge the truth about history just because I'm talking to a white audience. And a lot of people do expect that. I mean, because I think the biggest problems we have in our society today have certainly to do with race still. And a lot of it is because people don't want to know the truth about race, about racism, the truth about history. I think if we keep that up, it can't go well. I mean, that's why it persists as some kind of quote-unquote problem. It's not a problem. I mean, people being of different races is what makes the world, I think, beautiful and interesting. I always tell people I don't want 25 friends in my life who look like me. I feel like, you know, my life would be boring. We'd all be telling the same story. I like to know people who are different from me and come from different cultures because that's how I learn. You know, and I was raised that way. So I think it's really important for Black artists to, in a sense, be brave and speak the truth about a lot of these issues, you know, our history, you know, always, because it's the only way people learn. And I like to think I do that in my own work.
Valerie Mercer, thank you so much for your work and for your time today. We appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, too.
Support for arts and cultural coverage on Stateside comes in part for the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm April Baer. As America has grown into its 21st century debate about guns, gun laws, shootings, suicides, crime, and justice, the role of local governments has been a big piece of the conversation. The federal government and state government can legislate, but at the end of the day, it's mostly up to local police, prosecutors, sheriffs, and others to act or decline to in interpreting what the writers of the Constitution intended. In recent weeks, 8 Michigan counties have adopted language around becoming gun law sanctuaries. Kalkaska County is one of those that adopted such language, and Commissioner John West from Kalkaska County joins us now. Mr. West, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you very much.
How do you define a sanctuary county? Can you tell us a little bit about what the commissioners voted on?
Well, kind of my definition is that we're going to stand by the Constitution. That's what we were sworn to do, and part of that is the Second Amendment. Even though it's more of a symbolic gesture, you know, symbolism is pretty important in this country. I mean, we all recognize the flag. A lot of us recognize that American Eagle as well. So when it was brought to us, I thought that it was important that we should just reassure our people that we're going to stand by one part of the Constitution, that being the Second Amendment, which is very important to a lot of us up here.
Tell us a little bit about the gun culture in Kalkaska County.
Well, I mean, you got to understand we're pretty rural up here. Obviously, we have a lot of hunting in this area. We get a lot of people from all over, not just other states, but all over the world that come to Michigan, because we do have some world-class hunting up here.
Right.
And being rural on the other side of it as well, you got to understand that law enforcement's not always right in our back door. So, and people inherently have the right to self-defense, as they should.
Meaning to say, if you pick up the phone to call 911, it may very well be more than 5 minutes before somebody shows up at your door.
Exactly, and nothing against the sheriff's department. It's just part of the nature of the beast of where we live.
Geography.
Exactly.
Yeah. Can you spell out for us exactly what the commissioners were affirming with respect to, I mean, you mentioned that this was an affirmation of the Constitution, but what specifically does the language say about enforcing gun laws?
Well, we're going to abide by the law. And first off, we're not there to enact any new laws. That's not our job. We don't enact laws, ordinances. But we're going to abide by the law. And a big part of that is the Second Amendment. And we're going to stand by that and don't support any government that wants to take away our right to have that ability to defend ourselves or for sporting purposes or hunting purposes.
Were there specific gun laws that you were concerned about?
Well, some of the red flag laws were concerned, but you have to understand that we have laws in place already that kind of protect us from people that shouldn't have guns.
Was there anything in play in Lansing right now that was of concern to you?
Well, we have some concerns about, you know, who's in charge of some of the areas that affect our gun laws, I guess is a good way to put it.
Why do this right now?
Well, again, since as some of us are aware of what happened in the state of Virginia, and a lot of people felt that this could be attacked on our gun rights, and we felt that it was just time to reaffirm people that that's not our stand. We stand by the right to self-defense. We stand behind the right to bear arms for whatever purposes that may be that are legal.
For those who may not have been following this issue closely, Virginia recently passed some red flag laws that refer to how police or law enforcement might go about disarming people who may pose a danger to themselves or to others. You know, in the counties where sanctuary proposals have been discussed, it is pretty hard to find people who don't support gun rights. I believe it was a unanimous vote from the commissioners in Kalkaska County, correct?
It was, and we're one of the few boards that unanimously, I mean, it is a divided situation for some people, but we are one of the few boards that was unanimous, which is kind of good.
You know, if there's general agreement in the community and there's not an active bill in Lansing picking up momentum, is this a solution in search of a problem? I mean, what kind of scenarios are concerning to you?
A solution in search of a problem. Now, that's a tough one there. There's a lot of issues out there, and I don't have the answers. I wish I did. I probably wouldn't be a county commissioner if I had a lot of these answers. But I just want to assure people that, you know, we're going to stand behind the people and what they want in their community. This is their community, so there is a solidarity there.
I'm sure you've given some thought to what might happen if gun laws were to pass in Lansing and the resolution were tested. Can you imagine what that might look like for Kalkaska County?
Well, I think Kalkaska is going to, you know, stand behind our law enforcement. They're going to stand behind the majority of our residents because it is part of who we are up here.
John West is a member of the Kalkaska County Board of Commissioners. Thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
No, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And you take care.
Just to the north of Kalkaska is Antrim County, and it recently introduced a similar proposition, but it had a very different conclusion. Christian Marcus sits on the Antrim County Board of Commissioners, and he joins us now. Mr. Marcus, welcome.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
How did this issue first come up?
I guess it was made aware by citizens of the county watching what's going on around the country.
And, I mean, there's a Facebook group that has been discussing this pretty heavily, encouraging people to ask their local governments to take up proposals, creating a state of sanctuary in which, as they say, interpretations of the Second Amendment can be made in what they consider to be an appropriate way. What were your thoughts when you first heard about the proposal?
Well, I wasn't surprised when I heard about it. I was surprised at how fast it grew. The population grew by the thousands weekly.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people own guns in Antrim County?
I would assume so.
Gun laws have often been very hard fought on both sides, but it's pretty safe to say that the federal government and state leaders have been reluctant to act very quickly whenever legislation involving guns comes up. Given that the speed of lawmaking, you know, can go kind of slowly at higher levels, Did you and the other commissioners talk much about what local government's responsibility is?
I don't believe we spoke much about this topic up until the resolution was given to us.
What exactly did the resolution say?
Basically, it was an affirmation of the right to bear arms through the constitutional language as written, and cited, I believe, three or four court cases that ruled in favor of the owner.
Antrim County decided not to pass the resolution. Can you tell us how come?
I believe there was quite a few people who spoke, mainly teachers, actually, that spoke in favor of not adopting it. And, of course, there was a balanced amount of those who wanted us to pass it and to basically maintain the dignity of the Second Amendment. But the main topic was based on a word sanctuary.
meaning to say whether that was an appropriate way to describe what the county could do and what it might be able to do if this were passed.
Well, I think there was a unified belief that the word sanctuary has been basically manipulated by another user group trying to defend an illegal action that took place, is taking place across the country by illegal entry of the United States. So by using the word sanctuary city to protect those people, the original author who actually started this in Illinois was a prosecutor who decided that he's going to use this word and said, fine, if they want to use it, we're going to use it. And I think it spread across the country just from that one prosecutor in Illinois.
Hmm. Are there ways in which Antrim County has had to decide whether it's going to abide by other kinds of laws that the state or federal government imposes?
You know, we've been very fortunate that up until today, we haven't been on an assault like we're seeing at different governorships across the country, including our own. The threats to take the guns, the threats to do these, all in the name of gun control, but statistics don't back them up. And I happen to be extremely involved in our mental health groups in our county. I represent the National Association of Counties under Justice of Public Safety Committee. I'm on the board of directors for the Michigan Association of Counties and serve on the Justice Committee. I serve on the Northern Michigan Regional Entity for Community Mental Health and on the board for North Country Community Mental Health. If anybody knows anything about mental health issues and the best way to go about it, I feel like I'm well equipped to make those decisions. I was very confident in my vote and introducing this resolution to the county and expecting an unanimous vote as a yes, and it didn't happen.
Did the commissioners hear from the sheriff in advance of the vote?
Well, unfortunately, no. The sheriff chose not to make a comment. He said he was good, no comment.
He was good either way.
He basically said, when he was asked if he had a comment, his exact words is, I'm good, no comment.
No comment, okay. So that's sort of that's a pass for sure. Could I just ask you to explain what it was that Antrim County voted on? I understand that the commission ultimately decided to affirm the Constitution. What was behind that decision?
Well, there was a choice. During the Roberts Rules of Action in the board, we adopted and go by, it allows for a substitution either in partial by word or in its entirety. In this case, the commissioner chose to do it in its entirety. And as of when that is introduced, it is required that we vote on whether or not we're going to accept the motion to amend. The problem that lies in this particular motion is you can't argue its quality in reaffirming our constitutional rights. Who wouldn't reaffirm constitutional rights? So for us to vote no on that would make us look like we don't agree. I could see the twisting of people who want to be negative rather than try to be positive. So we voted to accept the motion because it affirmed the constitutional rights in its entirety. But the vote that I introduced was not given a chance to vote up or down.
Your business is a convenience store, right?
Right.
Were many people in the community aware of this discussion going on?
Oh, yes. I had an extreme amount of people positive and saying, thank you for doing this. I represent my county well. Mm-hmm. I went into this meeting without a doubt that I had the full support of my constituents.
Do you feel that it's possible for Antrim County to have a strong stance and a strong position on gun rights without this resolution?
Yes.
What does the county need to affirm about people's right to own guns?
We need to reassure the citizens of the county that we are not going to just allow our elected officials at any level to just go ahead and stomp on our rights without a fight. They need to be reminded that there's an election each and every term, and they need to be reminded what we're not going to allow them to push too far on. And gun-grabbing laws are just that starting point where we're going to say enough is enough. And it's our job to represent our local counties and as elected officials to reassure our people in our district that we're going to be the starting point. In most cases, like in Virginia, they didn't get the opportunity to meet at a county commissioner's meeting. They weren't given the ability to discuss it and form resolutions. The sheriffs had to act immediately. because the state had changed the rules and pushed it through their legislative actions and made it law through a Democratic governor who didn't allow this to happen. The process wasn't legal. Sheriffs took action, and now it's getting serious because as of yesterday, they passed more laws.
Just for those who may not have been following it, you're talking about the red flag legislation that was voted on in Virginia.
Yes.
People, taking guns out of the hands of people who might not be in a stable situation to have them.
That is part of it, yes.
Yeah. There are many number of rules, regulations, and outright laws that the state and federal governments vote into passage and that everyone may not agree with. Could you explain a little bit about what you think makes this issue different, that it needs separate action affirming the county's position?
Well, what's different is promises made by politicians, whether they're kept or not, the intention has been made clear by one particular party that claims that they are going to remove the guns out of people's hands for their own safety. Well, I don't like a politician, and that will include me, telling my constituents what's better for them. What's better for them is what they do. I believe that if I had a person in my household that was dangerous to me, themselves, or anybody else, it is my responsibility to do something about it. Not the state, not the police, not the federal government. So when there is an issue, whether it's mental health or someone who just has violent intention, it's up to the people and the family to deal with it. We've gotten away from that. And when we allow our governments to do this, we're just going to chip away at it. That's what we're afraid of. Chipping away at our constitutional rights, whether they're good intentions or not, when you open a door to restriction out of a constitutional right, it just gets more and more restrictive. And I'm telling you right now, the Virginia laws are doing exactly that. They are the poster child for what will happen if you allow them to do anything.
Is there anything I didn't ask you about this that you think is important for people to understand?
Yes. The number one importance that I believe in this, what this would have done in our county, was let people be aware of where their elected officials stand. That was my number one intention. You need to know if your sheriff's going to have your back. You need to know if your prosecutor, your commissioners, anybody else is going to have your back because you're the one voting for them. And if they refuse to answer the question, yes or no, that they'll support you, then you know what you're going to do in the next election.
Is it of concern to you at all to think that local governments might be able to stand on their own and counteract different kinds of rules in different situations?
Absolutely. Grassroots support is needed in all levels. As a matter of fact, at the Michigan Association of Counties, we look to our county commissioners across the entire state, both sides of the aisle, for direction on action being done by the state legislator. It's well known that the grassroots response is extremely important in decisions that we make.
Is it realistic to think that all of Michigan's counties would ever come to agreement on this issue?
I certainly hope so. Currently, this current legislative makeup is there, and I believe that they are supporting the majority of people's needs and opinions.
Well, Mr. Marcus, thank you so much for talking with us about this today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. You have a great day.
Christian Marcus sits on the Antrim County Board of Commissioners. Also, just a bit of an epilogue to that story, State Representative Gary Eisen of St. Clair Township has introduced a couple of resolutions in the state legislature to protect gun rights. That's it for today's episode. If you'd ever like to get our attention about issues in your county, go ahead and reach out on social media. You can visit us at the Michigan Radio page on Facebook, or you can tweet at us. The address is @StatesideRadio. If you'd rather go to our website, we have a direct link for email. Look for it at michiganradio.org/stateside. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk to a couple of amazing artists based out of Detroit about their own portraiture work. You've probably seen Sidney James murals around town. Justin Milhouse works in a slightly smaller format. He's a photographer. Hope you can be here for our conversation. You can check it out on the air on tomorrow's podcast. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening.